Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, commissioners. Dr. Thomas, Mr. Montoya, Jean, and members of the audience. This evening, we are meeting in Arroyo Grande at the City Council Chamber Room. So it's a beautiful evening, and we're in South County. The first item on our agenda tonight is approval of the minutes from our last meeting in April. So I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes if there are no corrections. Commissioner?
Could I have you use the microphone, please?
I move approval of the minutes, and I would like to add a comment praising Jean for the continually good work that she does, summarizing some of our lengthy meetings.
Second the motion and second the praise.
And since there are no thirds in the motion, I will, however, third the praise. And the minutes have been first, seconded, and with correction or addition, and so moved. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, opposed? Okay, we have official minutes. The next item on our agenda this evening is public comment, and I would like to welcome anyone to come to the table to discuss an item that is not on this evening's agenda.
Good evening, Bob Lloyd with AGP Video.
Well, hello.
I just want to let you know that we are doing some web streaming of your meetings. The audio files of the meetings are now available on the internet. The website is slowspan.org. That's slowspan.org. And you will go to the archive, the San Luis Obispo County and City Archives, which is a button on the left-hand side column. And go click down to the county, and you'll see the Health Commission there. So it's about four or five clicks to get to it because we have quite a few meetings that we're archiving. Our goal is to archive your meetings for an entire year.
Wow.
So just to let you know that if you miss anything or if any other commissioners would like to hear the meetings, they can be downloaded. Or if there's any of your constituents need to refer to something that was actually said or such. So we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Bob, are they archived in written form or in video form?
No, just the audio files. We record the audio. We record the audio files, and we do hope to, if you do move to the new government center, which we all hope you do, then we would be going to video files as well as audio files. But for time constraints and financial restraints, we're doing this as a promotional aspect of an archiving aspect that we're doing for SlowSpan or for AGP Video. So that's why we're doing it. You'll find that we have a state archive and a county archive. All the cities are in there. All the county agencies that we videotape are in there. And then for the state side, Coastal Commission, Fish and Game, Marine Life Protection Act, regional the water quality control boards that we do. We do quite a few meetings, and we are soon to pick up the Coastal Commission as well, as I hope. So for any other references to the meetings that we videotape, you can, and those we do the video files for, those out of the state meetings, we are doing. And so.
And that'll be a year's worth. You'll drop off.
Yeah, as you know, for space can, you know, as you can tell, that video files are, you know, very large in file formats. Audio files are not as large, but it's also, you're literally going through a list of a year's meetings on the site. So we're in still in development of the process, so we're hoping to make that a little smarter and a little cleaner. But, yes, we are hoping to have that in an entire year's worth of meetings on the Internet. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sir, would you like to go up to the... No, I told you the wrong thing, but I think it probably would be better for you to speak.
That's right.
I'm getting used to this new setup this evening. And if you would like to say your name, please, for us.
Yes, my name is Dr. Larry Foreman. I'm a local emergency physician, been here for 20-plus years at Arroyo Grande and French Hospital in the emergency departments there. And I appreciate this moment just to real briefly tell you what I've been doing. Last fall, I was working a shift down here at AG, and about two, three kids, truly kids, under the age of 14, came in with ATV injuries. And I said, you know, this is nuts. I've been doing this too many years, and I've seen too many kids. And I said, let me research this. So I researched it, And turned out that actually from January 1, 2003 through September 30th, 2004, we had 147 kids under the age of 14 who had horrific injuries, unbelievable. And most of them are a lot of fractures, a lot of wrist fractures, which are in kids, that's their growing bones area. And these things, if they're not exactly perfect, they end up with a lifelong disability. But it's also one of those, too. There's a lot of nasty facial lacerations, internal injuries. Luckily, no deaths in that period of time, but just really horrible things. And tonight I'm approaching the commission about hopefully an endorsement, or at least an understanding, of going before the county commissioners. And ultimately, my goal is to go before the state of California and get a statute to that effect. And actually, what I have here is a proposal for ATV restrictions. And I'll just give them that. It's got my card on there. You can pass those out.
Okay.
And on this proposal, it does list some specific cases. So just ones I went through and researched them all. And basically, a 9-year-old female, complex facial lacerations, abdominal injuries. 12-year-old male requiring surgery for a wrist fracture and genitalia injury. 4-year-old. I had a 4-year-old with chest and leg injuries. It was just unbelievable, the total amount. And I actually have them all logged at my home and everything. So, for anyone who ever has any questions about that. I have talked to Cacho concerning this. I feel he was fairly supportive. Actually, myself and Dr. Thomas met with him. And he suggested that I enlist as many organizations as possible just to show support. And then my goal from there, and once I have, the better part of the county support, is to approach Sam Blakeslee and or hopefully a Democrat as well to get legislation started on the next year. Unfortunately, I missed it by a few days this year. And so my goal is to get this introduced into the California legislature next January, and hopefully get this passed. Because in the meantime, I got to tell you, there's just unbelievable—just dozens and dozens and hundreds—and we are just one area. I mean, there's 46 different agencies that have off-road activities, and we're pretty fortunate. Anyone who gets injured here, it's a short throw. I mean, they get very, very immediate attention. If you're out at the Dumont Dunes, which is north of Baker, we're talking about hours to a local emergency room. So it's a statewide problem. It's a federal problem, but I'll work on that in my future years. But I would truly be extremely appreciative of the commission, possibly looking into this. I'd be happy to address on a much longer, timer thing. And anyone has any questions, please contact me at any time. But again, my ultimate goal here is to go before the county, before the supervisors. I'm going to talk to them one-on-one and then hopefully get a resolution. So, again.
In case anyone has a question who's watching us, the ATV stands for all-terrain vehicle,
all-terrain,
right?
Vehicles or off-highway vehicles.
And the venue for the injuries... The venue for the injuries that you're seeing are the dunes here. Is that?
Well, actually, my proposal is all public lands in the state of California.
Yeah, I understand. But what do you see? I mean,
from here, 90% of them are from the dunes. Okay. We do see some from private lands like that, and obviously, that's not something. Unfortunately, I can't legislate common sense, but But, again, the age is unbelievable. I mean, 4-year-olds and I have them all cataloged and everything. It's just, and my little moniker for this whole thing, actually Kay Mickelson came up with it, was kid safety. I mean, that's what we're going to be talking about in 2006 is kid safety, because it's exactly what it is. It's helping kids. I mean, to me, it's kind of a no-brainer, but we do realize there's some financial things, stuff like this. But hopefully people would still come here, enjoy, our area, but just have the kids do a little something different. So if anyone has any quick questions, I don't know if you can do that during a public thing, but I'd be happy to answer them now, or you can contact me.
Dr. Thomas.
When I first talked to Dr. This is on, correct? Yes. It's so quiet compared to the usual. Can you hear me now?
Come in, please.
One of the things that I was concerned about was, well, why couldn't you just have a parent supervise this by riding on an ATV? And it really shows my absolute ignorance that
there's only one seat.
There's only one seat on an ATV. And so it really points out how impossible it is for a parent to supervise a child on an ATV. It is not possible. And speed is electrifying and addictive. And so after talking with Dr. Foreman and getting a better understanding of the dynamics, I really realized this is the only way that I can imagine that you could keep kids under 14 safe.
I have a question. Is there a state law that says they can only, kids under XYZ age are not allowed to ride on these vehicles? And what is that age?
An excellent point. And the quick answer is no. There is no minimum. A one-year-old, as long as they can operate the controls, that's the only requirement is. But, again, we've had four-year-olds, but there is no minimum age. There is a statute that's been on the books for 15 years that states that under the age of 14, or actually under the age of 18 and a little bit under the age of 14, that they can be on the ATV as long as they're supervised by an adult or under age 14 by a parent or guardian. But they also, somebody in that group has to have an ATV safety certificate, which interestingly is not even offered in this area. The closest one, when I went online, was Bakersfield and Lemoore. So you can't even get the ATV safety certificates around here. I mean, it's not been enforced anywhere for 15, so they've kind of had their chance and it never happened. But there is no, right now somebody driving down there, you know they've got to be at least 16, 17 years old. There is no minimum age.
Thank you.
How are you proposing that this would be enforced?
Same way that the Rangers enforce everything else at the dunes now. Basically, when they're, and that's kind of the nice thing about it. I mean, obviously, if you go to the dunes, well, see now, it's a Monday, you probably will see some young kids now. When they're looking, 7 and 8 years old, that's a pretty easy thing. What they'll have to have is a certificate. If they're over the age 14 or older, they'll have to have a certificate. And if the ranger pulls them over, just the same way they pull somebody over suspicion of, drunken driving, that, they'll check them. And so it's just the same way that the rangers check now.
Thank you very much, Dr. Foreman.
I appreciate the opportunity.
You're welcome. Anyone else for public comment this evening? Seeing no one else in the audience, I would like to introduce Aaron Arlen Janae to speak on the particulate matter plan update, the Air Pollution Control District. Welcome. Yeah. Yeah, that would be great.
Can't she just?
Yeah.
How about she just takes this one? Because you've got to operate.
Yeah.
We'll be happy to share.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yep, the laptop's on. Thank you.
just having a little technical adjustment.
Yeah, and I can just get caught up once we get going. My name's Erin Arlen-Janay. Again.
Welcome again.
And I'm with the Air Pollution Control District. We are the governmental agency here that is responsible for attaining and maintaining the health-based standards that are established by the California Air Resources Board and also by the federal government agency, the Environmental Protection Agency. And I'm here today to give you, sorry about this, I'm here today to talk about our efforts to address particulate matter. About 2 years ago, we visited the commission with a guest speaker, Dr. Carlin Black, to talk about particulate matter, and that effort was really focused on particulate from wood burning, smoke. The APCD has been very involved over the years trying to reduce particulate matter in smoke from green waste, agricultural burnings, and stuff like that. I have 30 slides I'm going to be walking through, and typically with the Air District, we have a whole team of us that helps pull this off, so hopefully I can work through these slides in the allotted amount of time, keep everyone's interest. If you have any questions as I go through, though, please feel free to stop me and ask the question then, because it might get kind of lost as we click through all these slides. You have handouts. You have the presentation here. I'd also like to highlight this fact sheet that the California Air Resources Board has put together, and it deals with diesel exhaust and particulate matter from diesel exhaust, and I'll address that a little bit later. And then the last document is a combined piece with the Air Resources Board and the American Lung Association, and this document is a great reference. It's very easy to read. It has incredible statistics, but they're statewide. So it's not specifically for our county, but it gives the magnitude of the health implications, both on the number of individuals that are impacted and also the cost for particulate matter and ozone. I think this is just an excellent reference. Okay, moving on then. Here's an overview of my presentation. It's going to be a little crooked here. First off, I'm going to talk about a piece of legislation that was enacted in 2003 that is really the driving force for our immediate efforts to define strategies to reduce particulate matter. Talk a little bit about what particulate matter is, its sources, how it affects the health of humans, and the county. How do we rate as far as particulate matter from our monitoring stations and our emissions inventory, and then talk about what the district is doing to develop a list of measures to reduce particulate matter countywide, and how we're going about doing that will be the next steps. All right, so in 2003, Byron Scheer proposed and was successful in adopting a piece of legislation. It was called Senate Bill 656, and the goal of this piece of legislation was to reduce particulate matter. The coarse, which is 10 microns or smaller in size, or the fine, which is PM2.5, that's 10 or 2.5 microns in size, with the goal of achieving attainment for the state particulate matter standards. For ozone and different gaseous pollutants, it's very common, and it's part of the health and safety code that everyone, every county, every air district will adopt a plan to reach attainment of those health-based standards. But particulate matter is new in nature still. We're learning more and more as more studies come out on its impacts and the severity of its health implications. And you're just now seeing state law that says you will need to move forward with measures to achieve the standards. So this is definitely something new in the air quality management realm. And it requires that air district adopt a list of measures and an associated implementation schedule by July of this year. So, in a nutshell, what is particulate matter? I mentioned the two different sizes. It's basically formed as liquid or gaseous molecules combine in the air to form particulate matter. And the size is what's of concern. The coarser, the PM10, is usually, when you find it out throughout the community, it it pretty much settles relatively quickly. It's heavy enough where it will settle, and it's dust, it's coarse material like from ocean breezes, sand, dirt roads. The finer comes from combustion sources primarily, and it has more severe implications to the body because as you inhale these, and it does get inhaled through your lungs, it goes directly through your body. We don't have the mechanisms built in as a defense for particulate matter, and the finer are more concern. And diesel exhaust is a very severe toxic air contaminant that's been identified by the state, and there are a lot of statewide measures that are being adopted at that level to address diesel. And then its health effects, and I have a few slides on that. Just to back up, I don't know how familiar you are with the Air District. We are the local agency that has jurisdiction over stationary sources primarily. Cars, planes, trains, things that move between borders are addressed either at the statewide level and also at the federal level. So for here in our county, a lot of the sources that we are challenged with to reach attainment fall outside of our jurisdiction. So we as a state agency or as a local county agency need to work very closely to make sure that the state and the local strategies are both headed in the right direction in addressing the local problems. This is a slide, a great illustration. On the left, you'll see that's the human hair, and then over here is a cross-section of the hair. The PM10, you can see it is a little bit bigger, but not that much. I mean, they're both very small when you compare it to an individual hair like that. And you can see is when you breathe in and just walking down a dust road, we all know what that feels like, and that's much more of the coarse particulate matter. It's the finer things that when you breathe it in, you might not even know you're inhaling it at that time. Everyone is affected by particulate matter, but with most air pollutions, the sensitive receptors are more of a concern. Elderly, the children, children, since they have their bodies are developing and they're impacted, their lung growth formation would be much more adversely impacted by pollutant exposure, as would a full grown adult. And there's been some studies done, and we've been fortunate within San Luis Obispo to be part of a study that was conducted in Southern California. We were the northernmost stretch of that study, and it was up in Atascadero, and it was on particulate matter and children's health study. And we were deemed the clean location, one of the cleaner locations. However, in the wintertime, we were finding that our particulate matter from wood burning, stoves, fireplaces was notable when we looked at the rest of the state as well. And we have colder weather, so we're probably using those more frequently than they are down in LA. But one of the main conclusions from that study is that particulate matter is responsible for slowing down the lung growth function in children by up to 10%. So with everything else that impacts our growth, it's a significant contributor. And there have been many studies that have linked the PM exposure to asthma, lung cancer, cardiac, morbidity, and mortality. With ozone, it's been more respiratory. This is getting more into the heart now, and with more of the studies showing the inner link with the cardiac. This is a longer list, and I think referring back to this ARB document is a great tool as well. It shows in here the number of hospitalization visits and days work missed from work. It's a very good statistical reference for future use on the actual numbers statewide, and we're seeing all of those here as well. With this slide, the goal is to kind of illustrate the breakdown between fine and coarse particulate matter. For our county, we're seeing about half and half. This is a slide that illustrates it statewide, but we're seeing about 50% of the fine particulate is coming more from the combustion sources, and then the coarse is coming more from soils and tire wear and tear on the freeways. And getting back to the goal and what the Air District does here, a lot of the things that are captured in this slide fall outside of our jurisdiction. So we can't adopt regulations necessarily to curtail some of the activities that are direct cause of particulate matter. So we really need to focus on what is in our realm. Diesel exhaust is one of those that's being addressed at the statewide level. In California, since we have pretty severe air pollution in the San Joaquin Valley and down in the Los Angeles area, we're forced to take charge and lead the efforts to reduce emissions from these sources. We have stricter controls on our fuel in our vehicles than they do elsewhere in the nation, but it is necessary. ARB has concluded that toxic impact that we all experience out in the environment, 70% of that impact is coming from diesel. And you know, you think about diesel, yeah, we need food, and diesels are very instrumental in getting us the goods that we need. But then you also think about the children who are taking the buses, and it's usually powered by diesel. While we can't regulate diesel, we've been very instrumental in earmarking grants for repowers or replacement of those vehicles, and that's something that has been successful. We've contributed over $5 million here throughout the community in grants to do that. And with those success and the need to provide funding, especially to schools and other public fleets, and the success, you know, it's just more fuel for the fire and getting us to reduce that impact. This illustrates the standards at the state and the federal level. You have the annual average, and then you have a 24-hour for both the PM10 at the state and the federal level. And you can see how California has more stringent standards. And that's, like I was mentioning earlier, because we've been so challenged with very severe air quality, we've had to take a step and go beyond what the EPA did nationwide. While our region, San Luis Obispo County, has been very clean in ozone and just getting cleaner over the years, we have not yet achieved the state standard for particulate matter. We've reached the federal standard, but we still have the state standard that we need to attain. This shows the monitoring stations that we have located throughout the county. We manage all except for two of these. San Luis Obispo and Paso Robles are managed by the State Air Resources Board. We try to locate them in areas that are populated, community-based, where you can measure where individuals are living and inhaling the pollutants. But we also have two you can see on the eastern side of the county in Red Hills and Black Lake, and those are research stations. We put those up primarily to see the transport of air pollution because it just doesn't stay within their county. There are times, and we've been fortunate to have those monitors to show how ozone in particular, being lighter in weight, is transported across the state. These, I don't know if it's going to be easier to look at your handout or here on the screen. This shows the annual geometric mean for our PM trends. There is a dark line that shows the state standard. It's hard for me to see where I'm sitting, but you can see in South County in Napomo, there are bars that exceed the state standard, as down in the Guadalupe Road. In Atascadero in the earlier years, you could see there were some exceedances, but we have noticed a downward trend. Our trend has dropped. However, we're noticing over the more recent years, we're plateauing a little bit. Overall, we've experienced population growth in our county, so it is nice to see a downward trend. In the summer, or throughout the years, South County has been more predominantly challenged with exceeding the state standard. And in the winter months up in the North County, we've noticed higher levels there as well. Here we're showing the days within each of the monitoring stations where we've exceeded the California 24-hour standard for particulate matter. It's I don't know, you said Guadalupe Road, and you really could tell the difference there compared to elsewhere. But in Atascadero, it's pretty frequent exceedance, and in San Luis Obispo, too. And the interesting thing with particulate matter sampling, it isn't taken, the sample is not taken daily. It's taken once every 6 days. So we're showing these days over exceedance of the standard, but if you were to extrapolate those numbers, usually you times them by 6 to get the total amount of days that we're exceeding per year, so it's even more significant than these charts are illustrating. But on a 6-day testing interval, that's the standard methodology for testing particulate matter. Okay, so we have that data that we've gathered from our monitoring stations throughout the county. We then work with the State Air Resources Board and our local sources to identify the emissions that are coming from the sources. Sources could be anything like the area sources, roads, agricultural operations, and then point sources like stationary sources, refineries, gas stations, all the different companies that we typically work with permitting. We have over 400 line items in our emissions inventory and across the board with the pollutants that are tallied up. And the emissions inventory is gathered on an annual basis and approved on an annual basis in conjunction with our district in the state ARB. With ozone, you can see a great trend here. We had an ozone clean air plan that we adopted, and with that plan, it was basically the roadmap that outlined how we were going to adopt different rules and regulations to reduce ozone precursors. And this is a real nice illustration with those measures and rules and regulations that were outlined in the CAP, and as well as the statewide measures. You can't discredit how much cars have cleaned up over the years. We've seen significant headways in ozone. Actually, last year we were the only region in the state to attain the state ozone standard after we were deemed out of attainment. So it was a pretty substantial milestone for our county. And you feel proud when you put a chart up like this. Not every district gets to see something like this.
What produces ozone?
Ozone is nitrogen oxide, reactive organic gases, volatile organic compounds. The burning of fossil fuels is one main source. Combustion is your primary source. So at refineries, you have service stations, you have a lot of different activities. Even dry cleaners are a source of ozone precursors. Yeah. Mobile sources are the main contributor to pollution, period. But over, I think it's close to 60% for our region is for ozone, comes from mobile sources. And that's cars, passenger cars, heavy-duty vehicles as well. They're getting cleaner, but we're also driving bigger vehicles. But maybe these gas prices will have an impact down the line.
Does that include construction machinery as well?
Yeah. Okay. But construction is primarily considered off-road mobile sources. Now, this chart illustrates the ozone precursors as well as the particulate matter, and you can see how you're getting a nice trend line going down, but then the dark blue at the top, and which is total particulate matter, the pink, which is PM10, and the brown towards the bottom, it's not dropping. It has actually a slow progression going up. And when you combine this information with the air quality monitoring data, that's how we then try to figure out what do we need to move forward with to get this down and reach attainment of the health-based standard. So this, now what we know, the trends of the PM from our emissions inventory, we actually are able to pull from the sources that are here throughout the county that contribute to particulate matter. And the red is the paved roads, and the bright green is, the red's unpaved, and the bright green is paved. So you can see the large source coming from roads. I'm even surprised when you think of paved roads and the difference between those two, how much still can be coming from paved roads. You have your brakes, you have your wear and tear of your tires. Those are things that we kind of just take for granted. Yeah, you got to change your tires, but where does that go, you know? It goes in our air. And then you have fugitive dust from, that's wood-blown fugitive dust is the blue. And that would be primarily from construction equipment and activity at the construction site. Oh, and then you have the construction right below it too. So you have the fugitive dust and then the construction and demolition. So both of those two would be coming from the construction activities. But a pretty big cross section. And then when you think, okay, well, what does the air district do with these? These are area sources, you know. It's really hard to have a control that every road must apply to without financially burdening all of us. So it's a big challenge that we're going to be moving forward with. This one, I don't think folks will be able to see this. I don't know. Maybe it's my eyes I'm talking about here. It's just another way of viewing the data that showed in the pie chart before. You can see the actual tons per day that come from these sources and the percentage of the total emissions inventory that they contribute. But you have things like roads, the construction, burning, ag burning, petroleum marketing. And also one other item of consideration when you think of the emissions inventory, these are direct PM10 sources. We also have precursors to PM that we need to be concerned about, and those are sulfur oxides, for example. The different pollutants that once they are released, they get into the air, they combine with other pollutant sources to make PM10 or 2.5.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere back in my mind, my understanding is that there wasn't supposed to be any burning of agricultural products or any other burning, that the county had or the fire department or whoever had set up that there would be no more burning, only by permit. Is that incorrect?
Well, we've been working very closely with the fire department to restrict backyard burning of green waste from the residential applications in the developed regions of the county. So within the city limits or the urban reserve lines of all the communities, you can no longer burn green waste. And that's been phased in, and this will be the first year coming up in 2006 where that will be completely prohibited. You can burn on the residential level outside of the urban reserve line with a permit, like you mentioned before. But ag burning still occurs. It's just a practice, a common practice. It's probably the most feasible practice that they have at this point for their operations. They do work with us closely, and they have a permit process that's in place for those burns. But it's a best management practice that is still used here in the county.
Would you define the prescribed burning?
Prescribed burning, a lot of times for management of weeds and the fire hazard reduction, prescribed burns take place. And they can be on very large governmental lands, like BLM lands. They can be on smaller, more community-based lands. Sarah, did I get to your question? Yeah.
I have a problem with burning because I'm afraid it will get out of control and we'll have a big fire.
Yeah.
And I don't like burning.
Most of the burning that takes place is under permit. It sounds like if you're out in the country. So you have that permit process as some sort of protection for you. But if it could be restricted, our air pollution would be that much cleaner. Okay, I need to go on.
I have a question.
on the burning that occurs outside the city limits, is it all by permit only, or is there still residential burning permitted without permit?
It's with permit. Yeah. Now that I'm saying it, I'm like, okay, I'm going to make sure I'm right here. I know we just restricted the burning within the urban reserve line. My understanding is that it was through permit only that burns occurred outside of the urban reserve line. The permit is free. It doesn't cost anything, but it still needs to be recorded, and you work through the CDF to get that permit. They work in conjunction with the APCD. But our goal through this permit process is to discourage burning and to promote the alternatives. And there are quite a few alternatives that we've been able to help support, like chipping events that are held throughout the communities, countywide now, drop-off facilities for your green waste. We host compost workshops. We try to increase the awareness that there's feasible alternatives in place.
I just wanted to ask you about the cooking. Now, I presume that's barbecuing.
Yeah, it is.
No stove.
Yeah, I know. Can you imagine? You won't find that one on our proposed measure list.
And the remedy for that is?
Okay, so with all this background information, we assembled a team within the APCD, and we tried to figure out what type of measures would best suit our region to reduce particulate matter and to achieve the state standards. And these are the main categories that we were looking into: the paved and unpaved roads, burn measures, kind of building off of what we already have in place, fugitive dust, and when we say fugitive dust, we're speaking primarily at construction facilities, visible emission limits, refinery and calciner activities, and just particulate exhaust concentration limits. So those were the areas. When ARB went through their exercise, SB 656 required the state agency to adopt a list of measures that as of January 1, 2004 were in place, that were real measures that were used elsewhere throughout the state. And it was, I think, 107 measures in total that they adopted in January. And as a state or as a local region here, we then looked at those 104 measures and tried to figure out, with this target range, what of those measures would best suit San Luis Obispo County. We had to have criteria when we evaluated these measures, and a lot of this was identified in SB 656, as in what we have done over the years in developing the Clean Air Plan. Cost effectiveness, total emission reductions, the measure's potential to reduce toxic impacts, feasible, is it technologically proven? If it takes money, is funding available? Will the public accept these measures? Are there sources? And what time will it require for anyone to implement them successfully? Underpaved roads, I think this is going to be one of the more challenging ones for us, just because we have a lot of dirt roads here, and it's very costly to pave those roads. But these are strategies that are outlined in the Air Resources Board document. Things like street sweeping, watering, reduced speed is something that isn't up here, but it's another strategy or component of this strategy. Applying dust suppressants. There's chipping, chip seal. There's all different types of dust suppressants. Planting vegetative materials, paving, or anything else that we can figure out that would be cost effective in meeting all of those strategies. And another thing I might not have highlighted completely, in the requirements of SB 656, we're adopting a list of measures that we want to move forward with at a later date. We aren't adopting these rules and regulations. We're just trying to figure out how staff will allocate its resources in adopting a rule down the line to reduce emissions from these sources. Fugitive dust. So primarily construction activities, but there are disturbed open areas, paved or unpaved lots, parking lots, agricultural best management practices. And for this in particular, we were thinking of the track out. When I drive to and from work in the morning up and down Los Osos Valley Road, it's very noticeable when the ag folks are very busy moving produce in and out. And there's different ways to reduce the amount of dirt that they just carry from those dirt roads to the road that a lot of folks are driving up and down on. And we have that. We're an ag-based community. We have that all over. Like I mentioned, we have a lot of rules in place for burning, but we wanted to take it even that one step further. And we have the burn days, limit the burn days if you're outside of the urban reserve line and you're next to a smoke-sensitive site, which would be a school, daycare facility, a community park, area where you have children primarily. Requirements for burning and preparation of materials. When that was up there, I was asking Karen Brooks, our enforcement manager, what are you trying to do here? And we looked at the measure. It's poison oak. Restricting poison oak. It's poisonous. You burn it, it gets in the air. We don't have a rule in place, and it's kind of like the common sense approach. Of course you wouldn't do it, but we need something that we can point to in case folks happen to make the wrong decision. And permits for all types of outdoor burning. This is confusing to me right now, and I have to apologize. I thought we already had a permit program in place for all outdoor burning outside of the urban reserve line. I apologize. I should know this. I've worked in that burn rule forever. And right now I'm not quite clear. I can follow up with you on that and let you know exactly what we do have now in place and what the proposed measure will include. With visible emission limits, we already have rules in place that reduce the amount of dust, debris that can go from a facility. We have 40% opacity rating, and that's based on when you view a pollution source, the opacity of the dust or debris that's being moved out. It's now 40%. 20% is bringing it consistent with our neighboring air districts. So that's a very proven strategy that's in place and should be easily accomplished by our jurisdiction. With the refinery down in the Mesa area, they are the largest source of sulfur dioxide that's released into our county. It's a very large percent. 90% of the sulfur dioxide that's generated here in our county comes from the refinery, and it's mainly from their calciner activities. And down in the South Coast Air Quality Management District in Los Angeles, they have similar situations with refineries and rules that address their calciner and handling of coke and sulfur. And that's the aim of these proposed strategies. And particulate exhaust concentration, both of these, the combustion contaminants and the grain loading, are already existing rules that we have in place. It would just be tightening those up to make it more health protective. So this talks about our next steps, where we're going. In order to meet the requirements of SB 656, we have to have a list of measures and an implementation schedule in place by July 31st, 2005, and we're pushing it really close. July 27th is our board adoption date. But backing up from that, we have posted on our website now each of these measures that I briefly went over here today with more technical background information. We're going to hold a workshop on May 12th at the Air District, and that's from 2 until 4 in the afternoon. And on the 18th, we're giving a preliminary presentation to our board to outline the strategy and the comments that we received from the public up until that point, circulating a draft report in June for the public and stakeholders to review and provide comments on, and then going to our board for adoption in July. As you saw those measures, I don't know if you can imagine, but we're going to have challenges. It's going to be a lot of animosity, uncertainty, not knowing what these measures will be when the rule phase comes into play. But what we're really trying to focus on is this is our roadmap for reducing particulate matter and trying to reach the state's attainment level. They're just a list of measures. We're going to move forward during the rulemaking phase with a lot more technical evaluation on each and every measure that was discussed here in this presentation today. And all throughout the way, the public will be involved in helping us and our board make the decision. And I believe that's my last slide.
That's what I was going to ask you in terms of public input.
Anytime, we're open to public input, formally through letters, phone calls, emails. At our workshop would be an excellent opportunity for public participation, and that's this Thursday at from 2 until 4 at the Air District office.
And what's that address in case people are watching and would like to come?
3433 Roberto Court in San Luis Obispo.
Okay.
And our website, oh, it's up here, it's www.slocleanair.org. It has all the information, this presentation, contact information, as well as a link over to ARB's site so you can see what the state's doing. We would like to see support from the Health Commission as we move forward with our activities to reduce particulate matter. And once we get to a point where we have the measures going before the board in July, if there's a support letter or a comment that can come from the Health Commission, we would very much appreciate it.
Well, keep us posted in terms of as July gets closer, which it obviously is not that far away,
right,
about where you are and about the measures, the actual measures that are being put forward. And let us know.
Okay.
Any other comments from commissioners?
I just wanted to clarify. At the end of July, you will have a plan of not measures that you're going to try and enforce, but
right,
ideas of where to go to regulate.
Exactly. It's a list of measures is what we'll be adopting, and their proposed implementation schedule, meaning years out.
Uh-huh.
And once we have that list adopted, it will be the roadmap for the Air District staff as we move forward through the rulemaking process. And the rulemaking process is a very open public forum where we evaluate different rules that are already in place and how those would best apply to San Luis Obispo County. And we workshop those, we circulate those for review and comment, we present those to our board, and our board takes a formal action on a rule-by-rule basis. So of the strategies that I outlined today, those would each individually be going through their own rulemaking process.
And I just want to reiterate that you are looking for public comment and information, so and you gave the information as to how to best get hold of you and submit ideas, so that's great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time and listening to this. I appreciate it.
Thank you for coming.
Okay.
Our next agenda item is a presentation by the Community Health Centers of the Central Coast, a third quarter report, and Mr. Larry Bacchus, the CHC contract manager, and Denise Stewart, the CHC regional manager, are here. Well, I don't see Denise. We shall find out. Anyway.
Commissioners, could you, when you're speaking to the present, could you bring your microphones a little closer to yourselves when you're speaking?
Certainly, thank you. So welcome, and we look forward to hearing your information.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all for inviting us again to present our report. Actually, Denise Stewart had a day off today, so I told her to stay home. If that's okay with you all.
Sure.
But I brought Chris along here with me, Dr. Mitsuyoko, our pharmacy director. Anyway, as it's been, what, 9 months now that community health centers and the county of San Luis Obispo have been with this contract. And so we do have some update, some status, and even some performance criteria that we'd like to report of how we're doing thus far. So I'll go ahead and I have a short presentation, actually, so I'll go ahead and begin. Again, I'd like to thank you for inviting us again.
You're welcome.
Community health centers recently opened a primary care clinic in Lompoc, which is not in this county, but I wanted you all to know some of the activities we are doing as a whole. And we opened it up in last month. And as soon as we opened that, we started working on getting the clinic there at the Oceana site. We have the address. We are now working to build a clinic there. So hopefully we'll get that in place pretty quick. We also will be providing some podiatry services at our SLO clinic. This is new. This is not part of the contract, so just so you all know. And we will be starting that sometime in the future, probably in June. As we go along with this contract, you know, we still have problems with specialty care, so we still are working with the local physicians, local specialists to make this better. And that's an ongoing course that we're taking. As you all know, we have become now the safety net in providing health care for the underserved, uninsured, and indigent residents of the county of San Luis Obispo. We are, in fact, as tonight, I actually sent a proposal to a local Cambria physician to begin providing services in Cambria. So as soon as we're in the negotiating phase, as soon as we find out what the if he's accepted our offer, we'll go ahead and begin providing more consistent services than we have now. We are there like Fridays, every other, like 4 hours or something like that.
But your facility is operating now?
We just have a mobile unit up there right now.
Oh, you have a mobile unit.
Yeah.
Are you going to move into a different facility? Or?
Yes, the plan would be the local physician has a clinic already, so actually would be to just bring him in on staff and to work out of his medical office.
Oh.
That's the plan. Community health centers recently received some monies, about $700,000, to help provide medical service to self-help housing in Santa Maria and Guadalupe. This is housing that is kind of geared for the farm workers. And hopefully we're looking, with this grant from the federal government, we can look towards the, hopefully in the future, to provide the same thing in Paso Robles. So this is kind of, we're excited about this because this is, actually I'm excited about this because I'm an old farm worker myself, but this is really good for those folks, especially the Chandon, Creston, Paso Robles area where they really don't have this kind of service up there.
Could you be more specific about what types of services you're providing for this grant?
Sure. Basically, these housing projects will actually build a clinic within their compound. And that clinic is where we will go in and supply the staff and the services, the provider, the ancillary staff. And, you know, the clinic's already there, so all we have to do is just provide the staff.
Will you be hiring additional staff to cover these areas?
Yes.
And they will come under the supervision of your medical directing?
Exactly, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. In this slide here, you'll see the where we are located. As you notice, there's a little line here I drew as the dividing line between Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo. We don't have a red dot there because we really don't have something going on in Cambria, but you know, just that what I mentioned earlier. We do have a clinic in Paso Robles. We have one in Atascadero, Templeton, Morro Bay. In Morro Bay, we are currently looking for a medical office so that we can increase the size. Right now, we have a I believe it's a two exam room clinic. We would like to open it up to four exams, for exam rooms, so we can have two providers in there and provide more services in that area. So that's what we are doing right now. San Luis Obispo, we have three complexes. We have a women's health, we have the specialty care, and then we have the primary care, which is right adjacent to the hospital. And in that complex, we are currently going to be moving the pharmacy, which was in the hospital, into the annex. We basically got to go ahead, the building permits, everything that we need to get that going. Now we got to do this within, I think it's 2-3 weeks now to get out of there. We actually received a letter from the county to vacate the county hospital and move our pharmacy into the annexes as soon as we can. So that's what we're doing. And in that annex, we also have the women's health, which we move into another adjacent medical building there at the same complex, and we're going to put our specialty care clinic into the annex. So we're going to have the annex, we'll have the specialty care clinic, the pharmacy, and radiology as well. So we'll have a really nice complex in that whole area there. And then pharmacy will be an annex, and then we'll have the primary care clinics, which is not too far away. Arroyo Grande, we have two clinics. It's the urgent care, which is TDO, the doctor's office, which is open 7 days out of the week, and it's 8 to 8, except for Sunday. So that's where we have access to urgent care. Napomo, we have a clinic there, actually, which is where it all started for community health centers. Santa Maria, Guadalupe, and then the clinic in Lompoc.
Are all these clinics staffed by physicians?
Yes. Most of them are. Yes.
Okay, they all have. What about the women's health clinic? Do you have a female physician?
We have, actually, we contract out with Dr. Spaulding, and we have a nurse practitioner who sees patients there at women's health.
I'm sorry, I'm confused.
Yeah, we don't have a woman's.
You do not have a female woman, physician?
No.
Okay.
I just was curious, in the annex, is SART still in there too?
Yes, SART, I believe, will probably be in there for another year or so. This is what I understand.
Any plans for California Valley?
Where's that located at, Doctor?
East of Templeton.
Oh, he's in Templeton? Okay, yeah, as you can tell, I'm not from
miles,
here.
40 miles?
I don't think so, but, yeah.
It is an area that's...
That's needed, huh?
Yeah, it really is.
Is it kind of, like, way out there?
Yeah.
Okay. Benefits to the community. Thus far, we see that there's a savings, that the... county has probably garnered it, as well as CHC, and so a lot of that savings, actually, since we are a nonprofit, as the county, will go back into providing more services, opening up clinics, maybe up into the area you just mentioned, Doctor. And we noticed that the benefit also provided a medical home for a lot of these patients, where they have an assigned physician. For themselves or their family. So it's neat to be able to, where a patient can say, this is my primary care doctor. Access, as you will see further on in my presentation, we have actually increased the number of visits for our whole network. The increase for sure had to do with this, with the contract, because now that we have this the contract, we can count those visits as part of the visits as CHCs, but you'll see that slide, you'll see the increase there. And access to clinics countywide, actually before, the only clinic that CHC had that would provide access in the weekend was our urgent care clinic. And now with the county, we have actually agreed to open up access on Saturdays at our other clinics, like in Paso, Atascadero, and our coastal clinic, which is in the Arroyo Grande, and Morro Bay. So we are providing evening clinics there, which is after 5 o'clock, and also clinics during the Saturday clinics. So it's really... Yes.
I have a quick question. Does one of your clinics have a dental office in it?
Yes, it does. I didn't mention it. Thank you for bringing that up. Actually, two of our clinics. Let me see if I can go back. We have a dental clinic, which basically is more adult than peds, and that's in Templeton. And our doctor there is a Dr. Hoxie. And what we do is we actually refer a lot of patients to. Thank you. And in the Pomo, we also have a dental office, which basically we have. I believe now it's two full-time dentists, and we just hired a dentist recently, last 2 weeks, and we are looking to open up a dental clinic in Santa Maria. And we're thinking about opening up a dental clinic in Lompoc as well. Okay. Thank you for reminding me about that. One of the telltale signs of how things are going, when we first started with this contract, you know, it was here in June. We really didn't have a way to track or we didn't have a methodology of how to track these complaints. And so we didn't really have too many. But as we move forward, we see that it peaked all the way up here in July, August, and September. Then for some reason, it went down in October. And again, we were just developing the process of collecting the data, making sure that people will know who to call. As you all know, there's an ombuds person that they can call. And so then the numbers kind of rose up again. And don't ask me what that S is doing there, okay? Anyway, as we moved up... And as we've developed this mythology, we've now noticed that in the third quarter, that the numbers have actually gone down. And we'll see what the trend is as we go on. We're using that same data collecting method, where we will make sure that any complaint, no matter what it is documented, and whether we resolve it or not, but it gets into this logging. So if you notice here, it actually put a toll. So hopefully it'll stay this way. And when I say hopefully, I mean this is a way that we can tell how we're doing out there with the patients. Yeah. Yes, doctor.
Can you tell us how you're tracking complaints? I mean, are those people who are complaining to you, or are those people complaining to other care providers?
Actually, what happens is that they are now they can complain to either the front office manager or the back office manager, which is a nurse. And then those complaints then are actually sent to our COO or to myself. And then we get them through an email, informal, or they'll fill out a form. In most cases, what we do is we have the patient fill out a form so that we have it in a logbook or something. And that's through all of our sites.
Yeah. Well, I just make a suggestion. I mean, lots of times the complaints that we get with regards to the ER are very much secondhand. They're complaints made to other care providers, not in our organization, that then get filtered back through to us.
Right.
Did you know or do you remember about that patient?
And that's true. And, you know, we have during the second quarter, we did get a lot of complaints from other agencies who have been sending patients to our clinics through email or their email, Catalina. So all those to us are complaints, and we actually put them up here. And you know, even with the county, different departments like the public health department, immunizations, or whoever, will also be sending emails to Marcia or to Catalina. And so all those complaints that we get, however we get them, are on here.
It's my understanding that Catalina is no longer there.
Yes, she actually retired, and I believe they are looking to hire someone else. I haven't heard. I know they had some interviews, but I don't know who that person is yet.
In her absence, is there somebody that's taking her place to track and resolve complaints?
Yes, this person that she used to work with or used to work with her, Soshi, she's been the one that's been letting us know of any problems. This slide here is interesting. It's just kind of gives you an idea of what CHC had done within the last 3 years and with the contract. Here is 2003. If you notice, this is the number of visits we see each month. And what I put here is the number of total visits per year that we report to the feds and to the state. This is 107,000 visits that CHC had saw without the contract. in both Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County. This is 2003-2004. This we saw 132. This is again without the county visits. And this year we had a contract with the county where we provided the physicians. So we didn't count those numbers as ours since it was a contract that we had with the county. So, but CHC as a whole, this is what we saw, 132K. This is the number now that, you know, we're not through with the year. If you look at the number, if you look at here, the yellow, at the ninth month, we're kind of, you know, increasing up here. If we kind of just take the average of what we've been seeing in the 9 months, this is what we're thinking we're going to see. That's why I have the little wiggly there, about 200,000 visits. And now that's with a contract.
That's with the contract, right?
Yes. So, you know, so if you can look at these numbers here, so it's quite a bit of numbers for CHC as a whole. That's quite a bit of numbers that we're seeing. Okay, so just to kind of give you an idea. Yes, Jess.
The 200,000, doesn't that incorporate the former county clinic zone?
Everything.
Part of that 200,000?
Yes.
Okay.
This incorporates the whole caboodle, you know, everything.
And then the 200,000 also incorporates, for example, dental visits and specialty visits and other related service visits?
You got it.
That you're able to bill through the FQHC process?
Right.
Okay. For the background for the board.
Yeah, and all of this is the same. So it's all apples to apples here.
Does it include pharmacy visits?
No, it does not.
I just had a question about the difference in visits. Are those visits that are county contract patients? Are they county CMSP patients? Or is that the difference? The 68 looks like
60,000
more, yeah.
Well, some of this, okay, if you look at between these two numbers here, that's a 25% without the county, right? So let's say we had the same thing here. You take that, 70? So if we didn't have the county, that would be 160, more or less. So about 38,000 would be county. You see that? I'm just, you know. But as Jess was saying, all this is dental, the chiropractor, mid-level, LCSW visits, everything. And that's what this number is as well.
What was the county seeing before we had our contract, Dr. Thomas?
I only can report what they reported at the beginning of the Beelands, and that was about 40,000.
40,000?
Yes. Is that correct?
Yeah. If I may, one of the issues as we've gone through this contract is, number one, you have two different cultures that are going on, and so the very biggest thing that we've been trying to rectify is how we collect the data and how CHC collects data. So we've been going through a number of discussions over the past several months trying to rectify that issue. The second thing that happened in terms of CHC, when we looked at that original 107,000 number, the reason that incorporates everything is that under the FQHC process, they're actually able to bill for those encounters for dental and for some of the health education LCSW visits. Whereas for us, we weren't able to do that. So what we've been trying to work with Larry on is trying to identify how we got to our original base number and then how CHC got to their base number. And then our second cut was then to look at, of those total amounts, how many of those fell in San Luis Obispo County and how many were Santa Barbara County. And then the third tier in that process was to look at what numbers we were actually seeing in our clinics versus what they were seeing in San Luis Obispo County to see what the growth has been relative to each of the clinical sites. In general, and I made some comments that in the aggregate, when you look at the total numbers, they have been going up as Larry has represented. We've been able to take a look at that data. We still have some questions, but we clearly have made a lot of progress in the last couple of months relative to that background information.
But these numbers here are San Luis County or all CHC clinics?
All CHC.
All.
Well, as I was mentioning, 2002, 2003, these are fiscal years, by the way. This is where we you know, because we were also in San Luis Obispo County as well. So this is our whole network, the same thing here and the same thing here.
At our next meeting, Mr. Montoya, would you have the information to present to us about what the county would, had been seeing and now what is being seen in the clinics?
If Mr. McCous does not have that on one of his next slides, then definitely I'd be more than willing to come back and provide that information, because we also plan to share the same information to the board so that they get a sense of what's been happening over the past 9 months.
Okay, thank you.
Definitely.
We'll just do that next time. Are you kidding? Yeah, I don't have that slide. This is the pharmacy activity, and if you know, Chris is here, but if you notice here, we have in 2003 to 2004, the activity has increased, and basically this reflects our increase in number of visits as well. So it's kind of normal here if you look at this data. Patient satisfaction survey is, as I mentioned earlier, you know, one of the biggest things that we kind of pride ourselves as making sure that we are doing the right thing with the patient. So, actually this question here, there's other questions that we do ask. This is a question that is actually in the contract that was that we had to put into our survey to make sure that we asked this question, and which we do. Anyway, to kind of give you an idea, each clinic is surveyed once a month and done randomly. The survey is monitored and implemented by our quality improvement director. And in this contract, these are not all the criteria, but I put a few here. And basically, these are that are in the contract. For example, patient satisfaction, static score is 90%, we scored 99. Peer-to-peer reviews, this is where doctors, you know, family practitioners would peer review family practitioners based on a questionnaire that we have, and we're at 97. Immunization complete by age 2. These are HEDIS reports. We're at 86. Standards is 85. The registry is where we are lacking. We find that we need to get staff in order to get this going. We've learned just recently that we've got a grant that we can that would help move this along, so we will probably, I'd say the next quarter will probably be higher than this 35%. And what this is doing here is registering everyone under 18 into a registry. So if someone has been, that has a been immunized, can go to, let's say, move out of the county, move somewhere else, they would know what their status is with immunizations. It's actually a California-wide, so this is why this is important in the contract, and this is why too we want to make sure that we comply with this. Mammogram, pap smear, these are just women's well care stuff that that we normally do. This 56 and 62 is actually I really can't explain it, but this is a percentile that is on the internet, and so we're scoring in 92 and 83. And there's other criteria that we also have to look at. There's quality assurance, plan activities, access, which I talked about, continuity of care, and creation of a medical home, which I mentioned up earlier. I figure you had a question, Dr. Thomas. That's why you moved there.
Yes. One, just in relation to those kind of strange percentages on mammograms and pap smears.
Oh, okay.
And that is the National Quality Health Center status for all outpatient providers, looking at what for Medi-Cal patients, what the 50 percentile median was, that at least 50%, CHC had to beat at least 50 percentile of the outpatient centers in regards to mammograms and pap smears. And so the 50 percentile is the 56 and 62, and you can see that they significantly exceeded that.
Thanks, Dr. Thomas.
That's how that standard was determined. Right?
Okay.
Pardon me. It's not clear to me exactly what those percentages are of. 92%, for instance, of what? 92% mammogram well care screens of 92% of women visiting the clinics get those?
Well, actually what we do is we do a random sample of, let's say, 60 patients, 20 patients from different sites, and we have a questionnaire, and so it's actually a sample. It's a random sample of, in this case, 60 samples of 60 patients.
Okay, so it's just of a random sample.
Right.
It's not 92% of the patient population.
No.
Okay.
It's probably of the female.
Hopefully.
Yes, over the age of 18.
But I assume you'd extrapolate to say that because of your random sample, you would extrapolate to say that is probably what the overall thing is.
Yeah, well, we actually did a sampling of three different clinics.
Right. You mentioned you left out or you didn't put in every performance criteria. What's an idea? What are those other things?
Well, the access one here I didn't put in. This is something that is actually monitored on a monthly basis, and this is it's looking at the when a patient walks into the clinic, urgent, are they seen right away, mm-hmm. or if it's non-urgent, they seen within a week, and so forth.
And
we are meeting those.
But is that what the criteria is, met or not met?
Right.
Okay.
For example, on access, Marcia Bollinger does a check every month to confirm that a third available appointment for an urgent care is available within 24 hours for an existing problem within a week, and to schedule a pap smear or sports physical or other checkup within 6 weeks, so that that's monitored. Another one is that the fiscal mix, we wanted to make sure that at least, as I recall, 18%.
It's 50. You mean the payer mix? 13%, I think it was.
The sliding fee.
Sliding fee, right?
It not just be Medi-Cal and Medicare patients who were seen, but that a minimum of
sliding fee
of patients maintained through the system would be low income, uninsured, and that's another criteria that has been met.
I'm glad Dr. Thomas is here tonight. Thank you, Doctor. Ongoing. We are still participating with other community organizations and social agencies. We also have a committee, patient advocacy committee, which consists of different social and health agencies throughout the county. And we meet second Wednesday every other month. And this is actually excellent because we can kind of get the some of the problems that these agencies have in some of the services that we have to offer, and we can kind of talk through it there. Actually, Dr. Thomas is on this committee, as well as Marcia and some of the other agencies throughout the county. We've had two meetings, and so it's really good because we can kind of hopefully prevent. It's more of a preventive forum where we can talk about some of the issues that some of these other agencies are having, and we can kind of figure out to brainstorm how we can not have these issues. We also participate with public health, mental health, drug and alcohol, and other county departments. We also are a active participant with the San Luis Medical Society, local community physicians, and medical groups. We also contract out with some of the local medical groups to do, let's say, some hospitalists or inpatient care and other things that we need them to do. And we also are in participation with the above and others in creating a healthy healthcare model for the community. We, CHC has been involved with a lot of different things going on in San Luis Obispo and also Santa Barbara County, and also with some of the things that's happening in Santa Barbara County here. So we are trying to make sure that we are involved and know what's happening. This is my last slide. Basically, I just wish you all the best and the community receives the quality health care it deserves. Thank you for inviting us, and we'll be here for the fourth quarter report. Any questions?
I was going to say, commissioners, any questions?
I have one more question. You mentioned inpatient. Do your physicians follow their patients if they become inpatients?
We actually are contracted with a hospice group, and they basically will follow our patients. We do have our pediatrician who is following his pediatric patients in the hospital. But for the most part, we are utilizing a hospitalist.
And do you have any way of tracking once the patients are out of the hospital? Do you track so that they get back in touch with their physician or any sort of follow-up visits? Normally, there's supposed to be a follow-up visit when somebody gets out of the hospital. Is there any way to track that?
Yeah. What do you think, Doctor?
I can tell you that actually right now it's working very well. People get admitted to the hospital and need follow-up in a few days when they're discharged. Those hospitals, at least in North Canada, I don't know about South Canada, but those hospitalist physicians make verbal contact with the physician who's going to be receiving them. They dictate a discharge summary that includes medications. It sometimes works better through CHC than it does through primary care group's office because there's more availability for appointments there. I mean, they're required to have availability, and so when you go discharge somebody, it's pretty easy to call them and say, I have this person and they need follow-up in a few days. They don't all make it there. Sometimes they bounce back to the ER.
Sure.
But there is a mechanism in process that's part of the hospitalist's job is to make sure the appropriate follow-up is available when they send that patient home. They don't just discharge the patient to the wind. They discharge that patient to a home, which is better than it ever has been in the past.
Thanks.
How are you doing with your specialists liaisoning and referring?
Yeah, we actually are needing more help in that. I mean, we have a rheumatologist that's, we use him like maybe once a month. And, you know, with one rheumatologist, it's really hard. I mean, you have quite a few patients that need that type of services. Our orthopedics is doing okay, but we're looking at ways to make it better. So, and I just hear that the gastro specialists are not, well, I don't know if I should say that in public, but anyway, we're working with them. We will be meeting with them, and hopefully we'll see what the situation is with that. But, yeah, we are constantly trying to figure out ways to make it better. And, it's an ongoing scenario for us.
Is that the GI group in San Luis that you're
yes.
dealing with? Thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment that I've had the opportunity to refer a number of people through the clinics, and I ask when they come back just how things are going. And I think the most exciting thing is they do feel like they have a medical home.
Good.
And the timeliness in appointments and the other services that are being offered. I think people are feeling very, very welcomed, and it is very caring.
Appreciate those comments. Thank you.
Larry, one of your graphs shows that with the increase in the number of patients, that the number of prescriptions is going up too. Do you have the mix of payment sources for both the primary care visits and also for the pharmacy? Because obviously if it's a larger number of Medi-Cal patients, then
right.
there's more revenue. If it's a larger number of patients who are unable to pay, then that's a larger hit on towards the pharmacy budget.
Actually, I think that was submitted in the quarterly report. There's like six. Yes, it was like six graphs that kind of gave that. And also the monthly report, there's a payer source mix for each clinic that's given to you all. Yeah,
right. So. I've seen that for the clinics. I just wondered, had we gotten that for the pharmacy?
You know what? We can ask Dr. Mitsioka right here.
If you have not, we can provide it. We track it that way by payer source.
Okay.
I
I know we did clinic, but I'm not sure on pharmacy.
Okay. Great.
I skimmed it, so I that part of it anyway. I was looking at the financial part. Any other questions?
I'd like to ask your help with a situation, actually a couple of situations that have been brought to my attention.
Okay.
Sometimes in some of the clinics, people are finding, staff are finding that when messages are left for the physician with the front office staff, that it takes multiple phone calls before a response is received.
Right.
And I had a situation that was specifically brought to me for help from a patient who phoned one of the clinics three times, twice in one day and then once the following morning, because her physician had increased the amount of her antidepressant and she realized that she was going to run low. And after these multiple phone calls, I made a couple of phone calls, and the patient didn't hear back from the physician or anyone from the office. I didn't hear back from anyone, and what ended up is that the patient went without any antidepressant for 3 days. And what I ended up doing is my third phone call was to the nursing supervisor at that clinic, and I got prompt action.
Good.
With that. The other situation, which was brought to me for intervention, was with a patient who two phone calls were made to a clinic. The office staff was spoken to. A message was asked to be delivered to the physician who was busy at the time the phone calls were made about lab work for a patient. And the understanding was that the physician would then get back to the nurse about whether it was okay to draw lab work on a patient. And 5 days went by without any return phone call. So when I made the phone call, I asked specifically to speak to the physician and got the orders that were needed. And I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions as to how that communication barrier could be smoothed out.
Yes, actually, you know, we now are trying to educate our patients to, you know, instead of calling Catalina, to call the nursing supervisor or call our front manager. And if they don't get any help from them, then they can call Catalina or whoever the new ombudsperson is. And actually, if the nursing supervisor did help right away, that's our plan. In other words, that these managers will actually take the issue or the complaint and take care of it and also log it in. So was this something that just recently, or was it like maybe a month ago?
Within, I would say, the last 2 weeks. Both of these situations happened in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, because one of them sounds familiar to me. And I have a feeling I know what clinic it's at. So, but that's, I mean, if you can talk to these patients, I mean, you can call me as well, but if you can call these patients for them to talk to the nursing manager, that's fine, and let them know what the issue is, because that's what we're trying to, this is what I was saying about the grievances. We're trying to get our the nurse manager or even the front office manager there to take care of any patient complaints before it goes out.
And I happen to know the nursing manager at this particular clinic.
Oh, okay.
And so when I was asked to step in to see what I could do, once I got to her, the situation was handled that day.
Okay.
I would suggest, too, that problem that you're describing is not unique to their clinic. I mean, I even have that problem myself, trying to get a hold of docs or get things done for patients, you know, from their homes, who may call me back. And so one thing I suggest to them is to show up in the clinic. If they have availability of transportation, just go there. Because
exactly.
They may get seen on an urgent walk-in basis if that's what they really need. And
they'll be seen.
Even if they don't get that, they get triaged there. And then it's a face-to-face thing that can't be ignored. And you know, again, hopefully they get a pleasant response. But that's what I suggest to people is just go there. If you've tried a few times and you can't, that means they're busy, it's getting lost, but they won't shine you on if you show up and show your face there. So that tends to work in any doctor's office.
Okay.
That's true, yes.
Sure works in the ER anyway.
And you've heard it here.
You heard it here. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.
Okay. I was just saying one other thing. I just want to publicly encourage CHCC to continue to pursue specialty care, because I think that's the one place where we struggle as much as anything right now, and we're trying to help in any way we can. Larry and I were actually at a meeting with the orthopedic guys not too long ago, trying to encourage their participation. We all know the patients are out there, and they need everything from cardiology, gastroenterology, orthopedics, urology. I mean, you could name them down the list. They get the care when they show up in the ER with a significant need that has to be taken care of right now on an emergency basis when they get admitted to the hospital. But sometimes the patients who get admitted to the hospital who have, 10 problems.
Right.
We can address two or three of them and get them out of the hospital. We can get them an appointment back at the clinic, but we can't get them in to see the specialist. So I don't know what the solutions are, but there are a few that we're working with. And
I think if we keep working at it, we'll figure out something.
I would also like to encourage you to continue efforts in the recruitment of a female physician, as there have been a couple of issues brought to my attention in that regards, particularly with women not seeking care because there was not a female physician available.
Well, we do have female physicians, and in the SLO clinic we do have Dr. Anna Unglau, who's a family practitioner. And Dr. Spaulding, we do have a contract with him as an OB and a gynae doc, so... but we do, as far as I know that Dr. Ungla will see some of these female patients.
Thank you very much for
coming.
Thank you. Thank you. What do you say we take about a 5-minute break and come on back? Okay. We'll see you in a little bit. We're back. Dr. Thomas, you have a report for us. You're on next.
Good evening.
The Public Health Department report.
Public Health Department report. First of all, I'm going to talk about the medical marijuana cards, the fact that legislation was passed a couple of years ago that persons with a prescription from a physician could in time obtain a identification card so that when they if they were in possession of marijuana, they would have a card that they were medically entitled to a certain amount. And the Department of Health Services has been responsible for developing a statewide procedure, and actually the state will print the cards. The county's role is to take the letters from the prescriptions from the physicians and confirm that it is indeed a licensed health care practitioner, and confirm the identification of the person and provide then the information to the state. And that's expected to come online in August of this year. As Mr. Bacus from CHC noted, the county did receive a grant to increase immunizations in children. It's a $100,000 grant. There will be some efforts at the county level, at the public health department level, and we're also collaborating and providing some of the grant funds to community health centers in Central Coast to increase their immunization capacity in providing immunizations and also getting their registry up and running. For all kids under 18. And then the West Nile virus status, there is no West Nile virus identifications in San Luis Obispo. There have been in 21 other counties to date in California. And the mosquito abatement staff are out and about doing trapping of mosquitoes in various areas and also abatement efforts with the bacteria thuringiensis that we use to you act as a larvicide to kill the mosquito larva. So there have been no confirmed human West Nile virus infections in California as of yet, but obviously it is early in the season. The mosquito abatement program report is on page 2 of this report from April 28th. Finally, the managed care, Medi-Cal managed care work crew, I was going to let Mr. Montoya talk about that as he's the chair. The list of the advisory task force members are on page 3 of this report.
Thank you. In terms of the managed care advisory task force, we had our first meeting. The initial meeting was to basically get together, and it was a meet and greet, but it was also to kind of lay out a strategy in terms of what we would be doing over the next 3 to 4 months. What we want to do, in essence, is take a look at managed care and some of the models that are out there, the two-plan model, geographic managed care model, and a county-organized health system model. And what we want to do is identify what are the pros and cons of each of those models. It's probably going to occur that if we went down the managed care process, which it looks like there's indication from the governor's office that they want us to seriously consider that we would probably focus on a county or organized health system, and that would probably be by affiliating with another county organized health system, such as the Santa Barbara Health Initiative or the Monterey plan. One of the discussions that came up in the meeting, and I think Dr. Bravo brought it up pretty clearly, was his concern about whether or not we actually had to go down this process at all, because what we have going in this county seems to work well. In the discussion, though, the issue came up that it was felt by the group that we needed to do at least the due diligence part of this and look at this as a serious option. And then in particular, to try to focus on how we could possibly increase specialty care for our county. So the group is going to be meeting and moving forward with that process. We will be bringing in outside people to come in and make presentations to the group. We'll put together a paper, and we'll take that to the Board of Supervisors. And ultimately, the Board of Supervisors has the ultimate authority to make to either move down that path or not at this point in time.
What is the current mandate by the state?
The current mandate is that really the Board of Supervisors has the final determination whether to go down that path, but we're not clear at this point in time whether or not if this county were to choose not to go down, would they exert some other kind of pressure to actually try to push us down that path. So there's proposed legislation, or there may be proposed legislation to actually include us into some kind of a model, but right now they're giving the Board of Supervisors the final determination at this point to make the decision whether or not this county should go down that path. Great. Do you have anything you want?
Well, only that the governor's Medi-Cal redesign proposal did include a proposal for 12 counties in California to go into Medi-Cal managed care. And that proposal included for San Luis Obispo an expansion of Santa Barbara Regional Health Authority. And so rather than being driven into one specific area, we really want to investigate all alternatives and decide what the best alternative is, both primarily, number one, for the patients, and also to preserve the safety net it's important that the CHC community health centers continue to have a significant number of Medi-Cal patients, because it's the base for supporting other uninsured patients. So as a primary care provider, they are the number one Medi-Cal provider, will need to continue to be, although obviously a number of the children in this county are being seen by private practice pediatricians as well.
How will those be addressed with the Healthy Families and Healthy Kids initiatives, also with the Santa Barbara Health Authority? I mean, aren't those other programs right now addressing those kids?
Right now, the Healthy Kids is on track to start July 1st. They're going to start enrolling children in the next several weeks. And as we've talked about previously, it's estimated there are 3,000 uninsured kids in this county based on the California Health Insurance Survey, a third of which are eligible for Medi-Cal but not on Medi-Cal, a third of which are eligible for Healthy Families but not on Healthy Families, and a third that are not eligible for any of the programs. And so Santa Barbara Regional Health Authority did put in the only proposal to the Healthy Kids Children's Health Insurance Initiative, Inc., to be a provider, and so they are the provider for CHI July 1st for those up to 1,000 kids. They are also have been approved to be a second plan besides Blue Cross as a Healthy Families provider, and so they will be starting July 1st enrolling kids in Healthy Families. So that they will be here in that capacity. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay.
For fear of asking a rhetorical question, which I don't mean to, given that we appear to be kind of holding our own in the primary care arena and have the majority of problems in the specialty arena, is there any mandated incentive at any level to encourage specialty providers to participate in this type of program?
Santa Barbara Regional Health Authority and Monterey County Organized Health Systems would argue that their incentive to get participation of specialists is on two levels. One is economic. They pay higher than Medi-Cal rates because a Medi-Cal managed care program, they can choose to distribute the money that they get for the Medi-Cal population how they choose. They have to remain fiscally viable, obviously, but if they can control costs on other areas, for example, if they can reduce emergency room utilization, sorry, Tom, if they can reduce hospitalization, if they can keep people at home, rather than having them go into skilled nursing facilities, if they can help manage chronic disease such as asthma, diabetes, heart disease more in a better way for the patient, and if they can coordinate care by creating a medical home, then they can take that money, at least theoretically, and distribute higher fees to specialists. Now, obviously, one of the things we'll be looking at is to what extent have they done that. Are specialists happy or not happy with the Monterey Organized Health System and the Santa Barbara Regional Health Authority? The other thing that they say is, docs, it's a heck of a lot easier to deal with a local system that has a local board of directors than it is to deal with Medi-Cal in Sacramento. They know who they're talking to. They have a relationship with that person. Mm-hmm. They can turn SBRHA claims, they turn around referrals in 24 to 72 hours, which is a lot different than trying to get a TAR approved at the state level. But the proof, obviously, is in the pudding, and therefore looking very carefully at what the experience actually is, because that's the advertising.
Okay.
Mr. Montoya, do you have any update for us on the behavioral health director process?
Or? Well, we have basically identified one very strong candidate. We have done the background check, the initial background check, and in talking to the various people, the candidate comes very highly recommended. So we're in discussions right now about salary, and I'm supposed to get an answer tomorrow from the individual if he's willing to come to our county. So assuming that he is willing to come for the salary, then we'll start the more formal background investigation, and then he's shooting for coming on board July, somewhere early July.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. So I guess I'm on for the chair update. I have had a request from Commissioner Hetherington for a leave of absence, and I've granted that request. She at this time plans to return to the commission in July. So
come back this July?
Yes, yes. And I had very good intentions of attending the HIV Care Consortium meeting, and something very unforeseen happened, and I couldn't attend, so I will have an update for the June meeting on what happened and if they are requesting any support from the commission on a specific issue. So I will update at the June meeting. So that's it for me. Commissioner Wood, do you have any update? Okay, Commissioner O'Dell?
From the mental health standpoint, the Mental Health Board continues to work on with the staff on Prop 63 and the funding for Prop 63, and it's still an ongoing process. There have been a lot of, was a presentation last month, of course, to this group, and there have been a lot of input, and there's going to be a lot more. There's going to be public forums, one in Atascadero, one in San Luis Obispo, I think one in Arroyo Grande, and one in Morro Bay, and I think some smaller presentations in Cambria and one other, in Napomo, I think. That anyway, it's still an ongoing process, and the Mental Health Board looks forward to the appointment of a behavioral services manager. It's much needed.
Thank you. Commissioner Enns.
Yes, a couple of things. I attended the Bioterrorism Preparedness Advisory Committee last week, and they continue to give information to their various members about the grants updates, their drills that will happen this year, and just the general preparedness that we have in case of an alert. They tested the California Health Alert Network right there, and they had sent this out over, and everybody's beepers suddenly went off. So there is a definitely viable.
It works.
Yeah, viable connection there between providers. And then we also had the first meeting of the GE task force, and we selected a co-chairman, who is Dr. Steinmaus from Cal Poly. We kind of set our sights on what we will be working on over this coming year. We will meet monthly. We hope to meet the first Tuesday of every month. This next meeting, however, will not be the first Tuesday. It will be the last Tuesday of May. And it's a very, very good group of people. We are determined to be dealing specifically with the health issues of this issue, not with the commercial issues. And I think we have a well-represented group on this committee. So I'm really looking forward to continuing with it.
And thank you for taking on the position of chair on that committee.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Chamouzis. Commissioner Warren.
Yes, I attended the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board meeting, and it was educational. We two trainings, one on the Brown Act. Warren Jensen was there from County Council and helped the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board to understand how the Brown Act affects them. And also the mental health Proposition 63, Dale McGee was there also to give the same presentation to that group that was here last month for the Health Commission. And I reiterate what Dave's saying. It's really heartening because they're just getting input from everybody. Mm. So it's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Horn?
Yes, I went to Children's Services Network. There's going to be a meeting on May the 27th at the Economic Vitality Corporation at Embassy mm-hmm. Suites. On September 27th, there's a suicide prevention forum that will be taking place. Dr. Chasnoff, mm-hmm. it will be here next week. Next week is the 18th?
Yes.
Yes, the 18th through the 20th. Overseeing a dinner for OBs to hopefully improve their use of the questionnaire for obstetricians to improve the use of the questionnaire with new obstetrical patients.
Good.
So that's, him out there. And I think that's about it.
Okay. Commissioner Hale.
I've continued to participate in a number of meetings around the county with people like CHC, especially physicians, hospital administrative staff, trying to keep our call panels together for our ERs. It's an ongoing, sometimes struggling process, but we have noticed some improvements recently, particularly with the orthopedics and cardiology call in North County, which is very encouraging.
Yeah.
I also had a very good conversation with Sam Blakesley last week regarding our needs in San Luis Obispo County and his current education in the healthcare process in Sacramento. And he was very receptive and I think is very motivated to help us in any way that he can. So that's basically it.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Thomas.
Thank you. As your ex officio commissioner, I'll give one more. The Board of Supervisors tomorrow is approving a resolution commending the obstetricians, 14 actively, actually basically all but one or two of the obstetricians in this county are participating in screening for perinatal substance abuse. Not perfect, not 100%, but we've done extremely well in San Luis Obispo, and I really do want to publicly thank the obstetricians for jumping on board and doing this so well and yes. providing very important data so yes. that we can make appropriate interventions.
Yes, and the commission adds our thanks as well. Committee reports, Legislative Committee.
We haven't had a meeting.
If there was, I didn't know about it.
And I have an update from Commissioner Hicks on the nominating committee. She, as you know, has sent out an email to all of you and asking anyone if they would like to be nominated for the office of chair, vice chair, and or secretary, and that suggestions go to Jean White. So she will be setting up a meeting, I think, sometime in the next 3 weeks to talk to that group, the legislative group, about this.
Don't we have to actually vote on that the next meeting, or is it July? No.
No, I think actually it's on the agenda item for June.
June, yeah.
Yes, because right. New officers will take their places, so
in
to
July,
speak, in
right.
July.
Right.
So look for an update from Commissioner Hicks via email about that, and feel free to add your input to Jean. Community education.
We haven't met.
Okay. And budget. Right.
Our budget hearings will be coming forth in June.
Okay.
Those who want to make input should go to the supervisors' meeting.
Okay.
And make their input directly to the supervisors.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And then prospective future items for the last meeting of our year in June. Actually, we have had some input from the last couple of meetings. Let's see, Mr. Rick Castro was originally supposed to be on the agenda for this evening. He's the CEO at Arroyo Grande Hospital, and he was called away tonight on an official business, so we had to postpone him. So he may be available for the June meeting agenda or August. So that's a potential, as well as Dr. Hansen to give us an update on Medicare coverage for tobacco cessation. And then I'm in the process of organizing a panel of nurses to just give us an update on various opportunities, what's going on in nursing in our county, and what is being done to recruit and retain the nurses that we the nurses that we would like to have and the nurses that we currently have. And let's see. We talked about childhood obesity for June, but the more I thought about it, there is a conference going on June 17th. And I'm just thinking, and Dr. Thomas, feel free to give your input, but it might be better to put childhood obesity on the August agenda, because we'll have updated information from that particular conference. What do you think?
I would agree. One of your speakers today, Ms. Dr. Forsman, would be willing to come back at another meeting to talk about, give some more details and possibly for an action item if the Health Commission wants to take a position on
ATVs.
Yeah, I was going to suggest the same thing, that would like to see have what he is proposing. He handed out something, but sent to us all, and have him come back and make his presentation for an action item.
Yes.
Because now is the time, I think, and it's a subject I certainly would want to see some action on.
Okay. All right. So I think that's certainly, we have enough choices there. So, any other input? Okay, I'll entertain a motion for this evening's meeting to be adjourned.
So moved.
We got a first, second, and
second.
I'm going to use my gavel. Our meeting. Oh, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Our meeting is adjourned. Have a good evening and a good month.